How do you survive a nuclear explosion, an atomic bomb at Port Chicago in June of 1944? A plutonium bomb in Nagasaki, 1945. The uranium bomb in Hiroshima, 1945. Some did, most did not. The horrors of the Japanese suffering after those two bombs is one of the big secrets. It's not talked about much. And what happened in Port Chicago? Horrible, 321 dead. Had that been in a developed urban area, of course, it could have been 10, 20,000. Who knows? Now, these are bad bombs, big bombs. There are worse things out there, though, when you consider the simple fact that about 81% of Americans, 335 million of them, have been given the often fatal bioweapon injections, the COVID bioweapon injection. And many, many have gotten the COVID bioweapon virus. You don't want either one. Don't play games. The virus is not just like a common cold that goes away. No, it's very sophisticated and very dangerous. There's so many things pending now that we're seemingly are at the front door knocking. War in Europe, war in the Middle East, war here. We don't know. We don't know what the evil ones have plans, but there are things you can do to better your chances for surviving a nuclear bomb. Whether you're under it, next to it, 100 miles to the east of it, which means you're going to get doused with fatal radiation. Anyhow, we're going to talk about these things with Mitchell Henderson now. How to survive a nuke. Hello, Mitchell. Welcome back.
Good to be here. So, you know, the thought of nuclear war is terrifying to most people. People believe that the nuclear weapons will kill everybody, or that space aliens will deactivate all the nuclear weapons and they will not detonate.
Yeah.
In the 1980s, I read a Defense Intelligence Agency report on a 1950 Soviet general who was terrified at this prospect of nuclear war until he was part of a live-fire nuclear war exercise. They had troops in the field on maneuvers and detonated a nuclear weapon during the exercise so that Soviet troops would not fear a nuclear attack. This changed everything for the Soviet general. He said, a nuclear war is not just doable, it is winnable. In 1972, I was assigned to a tactical nuclear artillery unit in the Republic of Korea. I attended the chemical warfare school at Fort McClellan, Alabama, where they taught me all about chemical, biological, and radiological warfare. I learned about how nuclear weapons work and about the effects of the explosions when they detonated. My job at the Tactical Nuclear Field Artillery Unit, the 4th Missile Command, was to predict nuclear weapons effects and to advise the command staff on the effects of the nuclear weapons so that they could plan operations around them. I was the radiological warfare staff specialist. The 4th Missile Command had Honest John and Sergeant Missiles. These were frogs, or free rockets over ground. They were fired like artillery. They were not guided missiles. We also had nuclear demolitions that the combat engineers would place to create obstacles or to block the advance of the North Korean army. I shared an office with the Nuclear Support Team, or NEST. I have had nuclear weapons in my hands. I learned how to activate or arm these warheads before use. I learned how to increase the yield of these weapons. I also worked with the combat engineers on nuclear demolition charges. These were small nukes on backpacks that you could place where you wanted to blow something up. My job was to estimate and plot the damage by the blast and the thermal radiation, as well as the likely fallout patterns based on weather information I got from the field artillery meteorological section. I had to estimate how long North Korean troops would be combat effective before radiation sickness made them too ill to fight. I also had to figure out if our troops could move through that radiation fallout pattern. how fast would they have to go and how much shielding tanks and trucks would give them. Consequently, I do not have the same fears that most people have. I can assure you that for most people, the nuclear attack itself will not be the problem. It's what comes after the nuclear attack that will be the problem. I would estimate conservatively that only about 10% of Americans will die in a full-blown nuclear war. However, in the year that follows, about 90% of Americans will perish from the violence of civil anarchy, famine, and the pestilence that will follow. This is just my calculations, but I think peak violence will be during the second and third months after the start of a nuclear war, but peak deaths will occur between the third and 6 months after the start of a nuclear war. After most people have died, the death rate should decrease. I am a realist, so I do not think I could be in that 10% group of survivors. I do think I could be in that 10% group of survivors. With a little knowledge, you could also be in that group. So let me first cover how nuclear weapons work. There are two main types of nuclear weapons, fission bombs and fusion bombs. There are two types of fission bombs, gun type and implosion type. Fission bombs work by bringing two subcritical masses of fissile material together into a critical mass, which will cause an uncontrolled fission chain reaction, which leads to a nuclear explosion. Fissile material is material that has very unstable nuclei, which is easy to split, like uranium-235 or plutonium-239. In fission chain reaction, neutrons begin crashing into a nearby unstable atomic nuclei, splitting them and then creating a chain reaction where all the fissile material is rapidly split. An immense amount of energy is released. There are two main types of fission bombs, the gun type and the implosion type. The gun type nuclear bomb is the easiest to make. You simply put a subcritical mass of uranium-235 in a sphere, then put another subcritical plug of U-235 at the end of the lead pipe. Behind this plug, you can put simple gunpowder to shoot the plug into the larger subcritical mass. Oh. You could fire it with a primer. You can fire it with a fuse like a firecracker, okay? If you do that, though, you're pushing the blow up. Okay, but...
That's really only... Okay, how about a cherry bomb? Would that actually trigger?
Yes, sure. Yeah. Anything that sets the gunpowder off, that's it. It's no big deal. Keep in mind, this is why Iran makes U-235, because they could ship this anywhere in the world, and they could assemble a nuclear weapon anywhere in the world, because two high school graduates could easily put this together, okay? It's not difficult. The critical mass of uranium-235 is 123 pounds. That is a sphere of approximately 6.82 inches in diameter. However, if you place a beryllium neutron reflector at the core, you only need 33 pounds of uranium-235 to sustain a nuclear chain reaction that will initiate an explosion. Although the gun-type nuclear bomb requires little technology to make, purifying uranium into U-235 is technologically difficult. This is why we worry about Iran making too much U-235. If they supply the U-235, a terrorist can make a nuclear bomb out of it in a garage on Long Island. This has the potential to make a terrorist organization into a nuclear power. An implosion type of nuclear bomb uses a core of plutonium-239, which is compressed into a critical mass by imploding it. The implosion must be uniform when compressing the core, so this type of bomb is technologically difficult to make. There are precise lenses of explosives that all must detonate simultaneously to have a perfect implosion. When compressed, the unstable plutonium-235 will start releasing neutrons that will start splitting the neighboring atom's nuclei and create a chain reaction leading to a nuclear detonation. A critical mass of plutonium-239 is only 3 to 3 pounds. You can reduce that by placing a beryllium reflector at the center of the core, in which case only 11 pounds of plutonium-239 is required to sustain a chain reaction leading to a nuclear detonation. Now, you can use more of this mass, but not less. This is the minimum amount to make it to cause a nuclear explosion, okay? These are the bombs used on most emerging nuclear powers. Producing the plutonium-239 is relatively easy. Making it into an implosion weapon is technologically difficult. Terrorists cannot do this in a garage in Long Island. These are best delivered by missiles and rockets. A fusion bomb, or a thermonuclear bomb, basically fuses two isotopes of hydrogen together, deuterium and tritium. Hydrogen has three main isotopes. Protium is the most common isotope of hydrogen. It has a proton and an electron. Protium has a stable nucleus. Hydrogen results from the decay of a neutron. A neutron by itself outside a nucleus will decay into a proton and an electron in about 15 minutes. About 75% of all matter in the universe is hydrogen. Deuterium has a proton, a neutron, and an electron. It also has a stable nucleus. It is not radioactive. This is what, like heavy water, heavy hydrogen. Tritium has one proton, two neutrons, and an electron. The two neutrons in the nucleus makes it very unstable and radioactive. In the primary core of a thermonuclear hydrogen bomb is a regular fission bomb. This is what is used to compress and heat the tritium and deuterium in the secondary core, to fuse them together and make helium atoms, which have two protons, two neutrons, and two electrons. A fusion bomb makes a bigger element from a smaller one, and a fission bomb makes a smaller element from big ones. A fusion bomb is much more powerful than a fission bomb. Most of the strategic bombs in both Russia and America's arsenals are fusion bombs. These are precision instruments, and it takes skill to make them. Okay, so how nuclear weapons are used. There are three main ways a nuclear weapons are used against specific targets. Very high bursting, and surface bursting. The importance of the height of a burst is both the nature of the desired effects and the cone of destruction. A very high burst in the upper atmosphere will not do much physical damage on the ground below. It is intended to spread the electromagnetic pulse of the detonation far and wide to knock out electrical grids and shut down electronics. By detonating it high, the core cone of EMP destruction has an extreme radius, covering most of your enemy's territory. To achieve the maximum physical damage to cities, the greater the yield of the bomb, the higher you detonate it to maximize the radius of the cone of destruction below the bomb. For example, a 1 megaton bomb is detonated 1.25 miles above the target to achieve the maximum destructive effects below. A 20 megaton bomb is detonated 3.4 miles above the target. The damage done by these air bursts measured from the center below the burst, called ground zero, is illustrated. So the effects, the three effects are initial radiation, blast effects, and thermal effects. So for a 1 megaton bomb, the initial radiation goes for 1.25 miles. The blast effects goes for 10.5 miles, and the thermal effects goes for 12 miles. For a 20-megaton bomb, the initial radiation goes for 3 miles, the blast effects for 30 miles, and the thermal effects for 33 miles. Okay, so initial radiation is radiation.
Say, would you repeat that for the 20? The 20 megaton, repeat that again.
The 20,
please.
Okay.
Now how common, hold on, Mitch, before you do that.
Yes, yes.
How common would a 20 megaton blast be in a war with let's say it's a full-out intercontinental war with Russia. How common would 20 megatons be?
It's not common, okay. Listen, most are going to be in the megaton, okay, megaton range.
Well, I thought you said 20 megatons. Am I wrong?
No. 20 megatons is the biggest they probably use. But let me tell you, they instead of having a 20 megaton bomb hit in the center of your city, it's better to have a multiple reentry vehicle a MIRV that has one rocket, but it'll spread like 10 bombs out over area. Those will be, those are generally like 775 kilotons. So,
that's all?
So realistically, there'll be, yes, realistically, there'll be one megaton. Okay. Now, the reason that I always put down 20 megaton is you're not going to be able to figure out how many megatons it is. Okay. So the best thing to do is, for a safety factor, keep in mind, just measure it by the 20 megaton. So you want to be 3 miles away to defeat initial radiation, 30 miles away to avoid blast effects, 33 miles away to stay out of thermal.
All right, but let me go back to the one. What are the 1 megaton distances? Just for the record.
Okay, so initial radiation, 1.25 miles, blast effects, 10.5 miles, and thermal effects, 12 miles.
Huh, okay. All right, it's not as low as I thought. It's still up there. All right, that's got a big punch, even though it's 20 times smaller.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
Yeah, in other words, as the megatonnage goes up, you don't get that much of an increase in the radius.
Now I need to ask you another question. This is a tricky one, because we don't necessarily understand the psychology of the people pushing the buttons. Would these weapons, in an intercontinental nuclear war, an exchange, would the weapons primarily be aimed at nuclear targets, or would they be a mix of nuclear and just civilian disaster targets, like major cities? Kill them all. Let God sort them out. What are we looking at here? A tactical, strategic, anti-military target exchange at first, or are we going to just go for the people?
Anti-military and anti-economic, okay? Because you see, in strategy, you have factories making tanks and airplanes. You got to blow those up, okay?
Not near me.
Okay. Industry.
I don't know how much, as this company that makes tanks, I can't imagine there being many companies that make tanks, maybe three or four. It'd be easy to take out. This country is not prepared properly.
They're
not underground production.
They know where they're all at, and we know where all theirs are at. These are things that, in these modern times, you can't hide that stuff. So they know where it is. The good news is that they know where it is. They don't have to just carpet bomb some area.
I'll second that.
They know exactly where it is. Okay, so that's good for us. Okay. So the initial radiation is the radiation from detonation. This is fatal. The blast effects are from the overpressure and shockwaves spreading out below the detonation. There is usually a shockwave that goes out from the center due to the massive overpressure, followed by a wave returning because of the low pressure created after the expansion is complete. The distance from ground zero is for all blast effects, not just the areas that would be completely destroyed. Up to this distance, you are in danger of being hit by debris or otherwise harmed. In other words, the above figure is the safe distance from ground zero for that effect. Okay, so if you're 15 miles away from the average nuke that's going to hit, you can survive the initial blast. Okay,
and then you have to stay safe for about 5 or 6, 7 days for the radiation to blow away.
Okay, well, actually, you need to stay down, and I'll get into this shortly. You just need to stay down so that you don't get caught by the blast, the thermal effects, the initial radiation. You don't need to worry about that, because if you're where the initial radiation is, the blast is going to kill you anyway. So there's you don't have to concern yourself.
Yeah, I get
that.
It. Okay. I get it.
So the thermal effects are the intense heat created by the fire, by the detonation. The amount of thermal damage decreases as you go out from ground zero. Expressed is the limit where it causes first-degree burns on exposed flesh. In other words, a sunburn. Okay. Do not confuse this burn with radiation burn. This is a heat burn, just like a sunburn. It's not from radioactivity. It's from the heat of the explosion in the fireball itself, okay? So a surface-bursting weapon has a small cone of destruction. The force is concentrated onto the surface, and the cone of destruction is going up vertically, not out horizontally. The diameter of the crater may only be a mile wide. The purpose of surface-bursting weapons is to destroy underground bunkers, things like command and control centers or nuclear missile silos. The major side effect of surface-bursting weapons is fallout. Fallout is created when, during the initial radiation phase of the nuclear detonation, immense radiation is released. It will irradiate any material nearby in this short period, making those particles radioactive. In an EMP attack or air burst, there's not much material to irradiate. In a ground burst, a huge ball of dust is kicked up at the moment of detonation, and it is irradiated. This radioactive dust is then carried up into the air in the mushroom cloud. When it starts falling, it is fallout. It is carried by the wind away from the point of the strike and contaminates everything downwind. It is in Russia's interest to reduce fallout, so they have been trying to deploy bunker buster nukes that penetrate the ground before they detonate. You can penetrate up to 150 feet of concrete with bunker busters traveling at Mach 3.5, but faster than that causes...
That's half a football field thick of concrete. Wow.
Of concrete. You can penetrate, but only up to Mach 3.5, but faster than that causes the penetrator to vaporize on contact. A detonation would have to happen 300 meters underground to contain all fallout. However, even if not fully contained, a nuclear bunker buster would result in more local fallout, but not as much carried high into the atmosphere or downwind. So you can see the logic for developing this.
Got it.
Okay, the way the fallout won't make it to Russia is their hope, okay? So because of where the United States placed all their ICBM silos in North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Wyoming, and Montana, there will be a substantial amount of fallout produced. The Russians figure it will take a minimum of 7 hours for that fallout to hit the USA. By then, the amount of radiation will be 10 times less. To 7 hours before it gets to them. By then, the amount of radiation will be 10 times less than when it started. Nonetheless, Russia built fallout shelters for 80% of its population. America has built fallout shelters for only 0.01% of our population, just enough to shelter the pompous assholes that got us into the nuclear war. Think about it. Who has the evil, heartless rulers that do not care about people, Russia or America? In a nuclear war, most weapons will be air-bursting thermonuclear bombs and will not create fallout. Most nuclear war projections assume all detonations will be on the surface and are overly gloomy in their predictions. Worst-case scenarios always look bad. Another gloomy prediction was the nuclear winter prediction that said that the dust from fires started in the cities by nukes will block out the sun, ruin crops for several years, and cause mass starvation. However, although the thermal effect of nuclear detonation is intense, the blast from the explosion generally blows those fires out. You can actually put big fires out with explosives, okay? That's what they do to oil wells that are caught on fire. They use explosives to blow them out, okay? So the nuclear bomb itself, the blast will blow the fires out. Fires will most likely start outside the blast zone from the thermal effects rather than inside it. Always remember that the government always wants to scare you about everything because fear is the currency of control. Okay? So how to survive a nuclear attack? The best way to survive a nuclear attack is not live near a nuclear target. Nuclear weapons are expensive, so they will not be wasting them on your farmhouse 50 miles from the nearest city. Russia will not just hit cities with a single nuclear warhead, they will try to cover them. Most warheads are less than 1 megaton in yield. A 1 megaton nuclear bomb will totally destroy about 43 square miles. To completely destroy New York City, you would need 11 1-megaton bombs. You would need 12 for Los Angeles. Cities that Russia will have to destroy in detail will be our command and control center of Washington, D.C., our financial center of New York City, our food distribution center of Chicago, our fuel distribution centers of Houston and Dallas-Fort Worth, and our major port cities. The following ports are important targets: Los Angeles, California, Long Beach, California, Oakland, California, Seattle, Washington, Tacoma, Washington, New York City, New York, Newark, New Jersey, Hampton Roads, Virginia, Norfolk, Virginia, Newport News, Virginia, Portsmouth, Virginia, Charleston, South Carolina, Savannah, Georgia, and Miami, Florida. In addition, they will target our submarine bases. Those are at Kings Bay, Georgia, Croton, Connecticut, Norfolk, Virginia, Point Loma, California, Kitsap, Washington, and Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. And on all our carrier fleet bases, Norfolk, Virginia, San Diego, California, Mayport, Florida. And all our strategic Air Force bases, and that would be Offutt Air Force Base, Nebraska, Wexner Air Force Base, Louisiana, Whitman Air Force Base, Missouri, Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, and Malmstrom Air Force Base.
Minot.
Minot.
Just so everybody gets it right out there, Minot. If you have a small National Guard airstrip near you, that's obviously a second or third tier target. I mean, again, there might be 20, 15 planes there. They might want to mess it up so larger transports can't come and go. I don't know, but that's not a Class A target.
No, that's a small Air Guard airport or something is probably not going to be of concern to them. However, there are National Guard Air Force bases that have very, very long airstrips that are intended
that's
for like very big strategic bombers and
strategic
stuff like
and
Bangor Airport in Maine would be one of those. So you just have to check locally and see.
Gotcha.
In addition, they will strike our ICBM missile silos scattered throughout Montana, Wyoming, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota. The exact location of these silos is given by grid coordinates on Google. Anybody can Google that and see where they are. They're not a secret. This list of targets is not exhaustive, but they are the most important and are certainly targets. For example, cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, Davenport, St. Louis, Memphis, Baton Rouge, and New Orleans would be logical targets to cut transportation leads between east and west of the Mississippi. You just must look at what is around you and figure out if it's strategically important in a total war between Russia and the United States. So even a National Guard armory is not important here. Okay. There's even an army base is not that important. If you know what's on an army base, there's not a lot there that they need to destroy. Okay, but we made it easy for them because we had these base closings where we integrated all the bases together and we closed a bunch of bases down. Like up in Seattle, they call them joint bases. So Joint Base Lewis McChord. So it's an Air Force base and an Army base, which makes it easier for them because they can take out, when they take out the Air Force base, they will want to take out, but they can go ahead and take out the Army base at the same time. And the only thing they're taking out is basically barracks and some buildings for training and stuff like that. An Army base is not that important. Armies are meant to be deployed. They're not meant to hang around their base during war.
Even gay armies, huh? Okay.
Yeah, even gay armies, yeah. So this list of targets isn't exhaustive, but they're the most important, certainly, targets. Ohio said this. So you need to be, I would say that you need to be at least 50 miles away from any target. That would be a safe distance, okay? Because the closer you are to the target, then the faster you have to run.
A lot of people listening live near a town of 50, 75,000 people, no military strategic value at all. Should they be worried?
No, I would not worry about it. Now listen, if the Mississippi River is a major river between east and west. If you're in a town of 50,000 and you have a bridge going over the Mississippi, I would worry, okay? Because it would be real easy to just cut communications east and west by doing that, okay?
Right.
But because a major bridge over a major river is a strategic consideration, okay? So, but if you're a 50,000, a town of 50,000 up in the hills somewhere, in a tourist destination, they're not uninterested in that, okay? So that wouldn't be a problem. When a nuclear detonation takes place, you need to not look at it as the light can blind you. You need to take cover from both fine debris and thermal heat. Being in the shadow of the thermal radiation is important. A ditch is great for this, but any cover at all helps. If there is no cover, drop flat, facing away from the blast, and stay down until it is over. Stay down until all the blast and thermal effects are over. Then move quickly to get to your initial survival camp. The longer you linger, the more traffic you will have to endure. If you can take cover, then you can survive a nuclear attack. And this would be even a small drainage ditch can give you some shadow. Anything. Okay? A stout wall. If you're far enough away, the blast isn't going to knock that wall down. You're protecting yourself from flying debris at that point. Okay? Not from a building collapsing on you. Okay? So World War III will be over in an hour. Then the hard part begins, the part where you must survive the aftermath. War brings out both the bad and the good in people. Once all authority has been destroyed, you will quickly see how people are. Most people are more evil or more selfish than you can imagine.
Yes,
in peacetime,
well said.
Don't go ahead. Yeah.
No, it's well said. It's true. I'm sorry, but you're right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In peacetime, we live under the illusion and myth that most people are good people. This is simply not true. Trust God, but be very wary of other human beings. Okay? So I am going to talk about fallout, because fallout may be an issue. It may not be. Okay? Probably for most people it won't be, but for some people it will be. Okay? About an hour after a nuclear explosion, fallout begins to fall. You cannot see radiation, so it would be wise to invest in a radiation detector. You can get some inexpensive ones that will let you know if there is radiation or not, or get a more expensive detectors that will tell you how much radiation there is.
Yeah, just they have dosimeters out there online. All you need is a dosimeter. They're $100, something like that. A good one.
Yeah, I like to get these little. It's almost like the size of a cell phone. And it starts making the noise when it detects radiation. It's kind of handy because you can just have it on, and when it starts, you know, beep, 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 then you know that there's radiation around.
Yeah, I have one like that. It's forget the name of it. It's about $500, but yeah, I got it.
I got one like that. It was like $185, something like that. It wasn't terribly expensive. So radiation is measured in rads, or radiation absorbed dose. A gray is a measure of absorbed radiation used by civilians. One gray equals 100 rads. Okay. So civilian guidelines. These are civilian guidelines. 35 rads can make you sick. So that's 3.5 grays. Okay. 100 rads will give you radiation sickness that you have a 5% chance of dying from. 250 rads is the LD50, where half will die and half will survive. 600 rads is almost always fatal. Now, the military guidelines are a little bit different because you have healthy soldiers, okay? So 50 to 200 rads is radiation sickness in 24 hours, and sick a few days, 5% fatal. 200 to 450 rads, radiation sickness in 3 to 6 hours, sick for a few days, less than 50% fatal. 450 to 600 rads, radiation sickness in an hour, sick several days, more than 50% fatal. Greater than 600 rads, 100% fatal. Greater than 2,000 rads, fatal within hours. So the military is reckoning that soldiers are in better shape than civilians. Your radiation detection meter will read in Rinkens or Sieverts. This makes it confusing. So in my book, the Final Wars, I put down a conversion table so you convert. So one grad is 100 rads, one sievert is 100 Rinkens, and one Rinken is 0.877 rads. Okay, so you just think one Rinken is like one rad. So a sievert is 100 Rinkens. Because what I'm talking about is the radiation dosimeter that you have is going to be in sieverts, Rinkens, and sometimes grays, sometimes rads. So it's just what I do is I just convert roughly as a Rinken being a rad. Okay. So radiation measured at a crater.
I found my radiation meter. It's called an Inspector.
Oh.
That's the name of it. Inspector.
Okay.
It's very good. I used it after Fukushima quite a bit.
Oh, did you?
I think there's...
Yeah, cool. So...
An Inspector. All right.
So if you're a civilian, think about it this way. If you get the normal amount of x-rays in a year, so you're at Klutz and you have to get x-rays once in a while, that's usually about one rad in a year. A CAT scan, if you get a CAT scan, that's about 35 rads in one time, okay? And you normally never get sick from that, okay? So radiation, now this is just to give you an idea of how much radiation is there after nuclear blast. Radiation measured at a crater 1 hour after a surface-bursting nuclear detonation was measured at 30 grays, or 3,000 rads. That is almost immediately fatal, okay? That's one hour after the detonation, okay? So you don't want to approach any craters, okay? But radiation decays quickly. We can calculate the decay by the 710 rule. For every multiple of 7 hours, the radiation intensity decreases by a factor of 10. Therefore, starting 1 hour after the detonation, 7 hours later, the radiation at the crater is down to 300 rads. This is still enough to kill you. 49 hours later, the radiation at the crater will be down to 30 rads. That's about a CAT scan amount of radiation. Okay. 2 weeks after that, the radiation will be down to 3 rads. Okay. However, keep in mind that what hurts you is absorbed doses. In other words, 600 rads is fatal, but if you must run out and get something, and it takes you 1 minute to do so, you will have absorbed only 10 rads. After 2 weeks, when radiation is down to 3 rads, and you spend an hour outside, you will accumulate 180 rads, which will make you sick. 14 weeks after the detonation, that radiation will be down to 0.3 rads, giving you an exposure of 1.8 rads for being outside for an hour. That will be safer, but as you can see, you should spend as much time in your shelter as possible. Definitely sleep in a shelter for a very long time if you are in a fallout-contaminated area. When the radiation is down enough where you can travel for several hours per day, walk perpendicular to the downwind path of radiation and try to get out of the contaminated area. Seek shelter to rest until you are clear of the contaminated area. The U.S. Air Force instructs its pilots who are downed in a nuclear fallout area to follow the following schedule for exposure. Remain in shelter for at least 6 days after the last explosion. Day 7, you can go out for 30 minutes maximum. Day 8, you can go out for 1 hour maximum. Day 9 through 12, you can go out 2 to 4 hours per day maximum. By now, hopefully, you are out of the contaminated area. Keep in mind that most nuclear detonations will be air bursts that do not produce fallout. However, you may have surface bursts upwind, in which case you will have fallout. This is why radiation detector device is a good thing to have. It's the only way you will know, for sure. What constitutes a shelter from radioactive fallout? Either 1 foot of reinforced concrete or 3 feet of packed earth. You can dig a foxhole, put some logs down, and cover it with 3 feet of packed dirt. Just remember in your construction that radiation travels in a straight line. It cannot go around corners. Later, when you are checking out to find an uncontaminated area, you can rest at night by digging a slit trench to sleep in. If you are laying below ground level, the radiation will not bend over into the trench. It will go in straight lines over it.
Okay? All right.
So, finally, let me cover food in a fallout contaminated area. Radioactive decay consists of alpha, beta, and gamma radiation. Alpha particles are 2 neutrons and 2 protons that leave the nucleus during radioactive decay. It is a helium nucleus. Your skin stops alpha radiation. Beta particles are high-energy electrons that leave the nucleus during radioactive decay. It is an electron. Your clothing stops beta radiation. Alpha and beta radiation are not a big problem for you unless it gets inside your body where you have no shielding. If you eat it or drink it, it will kill you. Eating and drinking in a post-nuclear attack situation requires some care. Bottled water is fine. Just make sure that you clean the outside of the bottle because that is where the radioactive particles will be. Water from springs or underground sources are safest. Inside buildings, water in pipes or containers is safe. After several days, water from rapidly running streams should be good. If there is snow, take the snow that is at least a half a foot down for melting.
In other words, right there. Go six inches down before you melt snow for drinking and using. That's good.
Right. Very good. When in doubt, filter. Put holes in the bottom of a bucket. Put pebbles on the bottom about 1.5 inches. Then put 7 inches of clay on top of that. When digging the clay, take it from at least 4 inches from below the surface. The first 4 inches are likely to be contaminated. Put a cloth over this and put clear water on top to filter. Put a clean bucket underneath to catch the filtered water. Do not drink water from ponds, lakes, and pools. A canned food is safe to eat. You must clean the top of the can off so that the can opener does not drive radioactive particles into
good,
the food.
Good.
Anything packaged so that dust or fluid cannot get in is safe to eat. You can eat root plants, just scrub and peel them. Other fruits should be washed well and then peeled. Do not eat greens like lettuce because it's hard to get all the particles off. You can eat game, but do not eat any organs and leave at least 1/4 inch of meat around the bone. Bones collect radioactive
elements. Leave at least a quarter inch of meat around your prime rib.
Bones collect radioactive elements, so that you keep that in mind. Make sure no dust from the skin gets on the meat. Okay, so eating potassium iodide pills helps keep you from absorbing radioactive iodine into your thyroid, and I think there would be no harm in eating calcium carbonate, TERMS, to keep radioactive alkaline earth elements from absorbing into your bones. And those are two fairly common things. Some are very common. You can pick up potassium iodide here and there. You probably buy it online with no problem at all.
Yeah. All right. So, excellent advice. Is this advice in your book?
Yes. So in the book, the book that I just published, The Final Wars, How to Survive the Coming Civil War in America, World War III, and the Collapse of Civilization, has a whole chapter on surviving nuclear war. And it's got all the facts and figures in there for reference. Okay.
Got it. All right. And to get the book, you simply go to Amazon. It's the quickest way to go. Look up Mitchell Henderson.
Yeah, just go to Amazon and just type in The Final Wars, and it'll come up to the. And let me tell you, this is a different survival book, because I'm not just telling you how to fight in the countryside, how to fight in the city, how to prepare, how to survive nuclear war. I also try to explain to you how civil wars begin, how world wars begin, and I explain to you geopolitics from the point of view of Iran, Russia, North Korea, China, and Israel, and the United States, so that you can figure things out for yourself and see the war coming. Okay, because our media lies to you so badly. Okay,
nonstop.
It's just nonstop. Listen, we can see several examples recently. Like, everybody knows that the Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, were eating cats and dogs and ducks and whatever. Okay, I mean, there's tons of film out there, TikToks and videos about this. Plenty of reports from people there. But see, the mainstream media asked the mayor, who's a woke mayor. He's a Republican, but he's a woke guy. They asked the mayor, and he says, oh, no, that's not true. Sort of like the mayor of Aurora, Colorado, denies that the train to Agua is taking over apartment buildings. Okay, you can see with your own eyes that they're doing it, but the mayor is not going to tell you the truth. But the government will never tell you the truth. Okay, but other people that go out there, real human beings that go out and ask real questions, which is called disinformation, okay, they will tell you what it's like. So we can see that they do this. Another example is just last week, Mallorca said, well, we don't have enough money in FEMA to take care of these people that were hit by the hurricane in North Carolina, because they took $1 billion and gave it to illegal aliens, okay? And then Mayorkas said that himself on TV. And if you look at the news, mainstream media today, they say that's disinformation, that's a lie. That did not happen.
And
the news says that FEMA's on the ground in North Carolina taking care of people, and the head of FEMA is saying this disinformation is bad because nobody will apply for the aid. So they can't get aid to people if nobody applies. And they say the disinformation is making it so that people will not apply. Well, listen, people will not apply because there's no telephone, there's no way for people to communicate. And if Elon Musk wants to go in there and distribute Starlink, they say absolutely not. You know, if you want to go in as a private individual and help out, FEMA is there to stop you from helping. Okay,
and you got it. Mitch, we're seeing that now in North Carolina. Yeah.
People on the ground are saying the government's not there doing anything, but we are to believe that the government's just warmly taking care of everybody. There's nothing to worry about. Move along, folks. Nothing to see here. They're, in fact, doing nothing. If you see people distributing food and housing people, that is their neighbors doing that. That is not the government doing that. So that's why I think it's important that you understand the truth of things so that you can decide for yourself. Like, if you listen to the government, you think we can just keep pushing Russia, crossing their lines, because they're not going to respond, okay? But if you understand the situation from Russia's point of view, you will know that they absolutely will respond. If we do what they tell us not to do, they will respond. And you will understand why they respond. And the reason I said you're going to understand is not because you're going to see things like you're going to be pro-Russian. It's going to be that you understand the situation from the Russian point of view, and you understand that they're backed into a corner and they will fight. Okay? That's the difference.
Got it.
So.
Okay. This is a tough one because families, individual, couple, how much food per person are you currently recommended that people have stocked up. And not talking about
well,
the other people. Go ahead. Real quick. We only have about a minute.
I think
go ahead.
You should have like a year's supply of food if you can. Just as much as you can, but keep this in mind. What you want to do, that food is not there for you to eat and sustain yourself for the indefinite future. That's to help you out when you're learning how to gather plants and animals in your area to eat, how to hunt, how to fish. And until you can sustain yourself, you need to have some food to back up, because you can't afford to allow yourself to get weak. Okay?
Got it. Okay, very good. Wow. Well, that was quite a tour. And it's all in Mitchell's book. Again, you can just go to Amazon, and it's The Final War. There it is. Or you can put in Mitchell Henderson. You can get it that way, too. All right, my friend, thank you. You be safe, and we'll talk
welcome.
To you next week. Okay, Mitch.
Good okay. Night. All right. Bye-bye.
Class gentlemen, all the way. Okay, that's it for Monday. Back with you tomorrow night. Take good care and prepare if you can. Talk tomorrow.